At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Mornings can start feeling the same. Wake up, brush teeth, go to work. But with breakfast from Wendy's, it's like, wake up, brush teeth, baconate with a breakfast baconator, roll with the sausage breakfast burrito, buddy it up with a honey buddy, or get seasoned with seasoned potatoes, and then go to work. Sorry. When you're ready for a fresh wake-up call, gotta be Wendy's.
At participating U.S. Wendy's during breakfast hours.
Lowe's knows that no matter your paint project, saving is at the top of your list. That's why when you shop today, you can buy one, get one free select Valspar and HGTV Home by Sherwin-Williams one-coat coverage interior paints via rebate. Shop these deals in-store or online today at Lowe's. We help, you save. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. Discount taken at time of purchase. See sales associate for details. Offer valid 8/21 through 9/3.
This is Hidden Killers Week in Review.
A look back at the most prolific stories of the week.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Well, another documentary is out, and with it comes renewed interest in the case of Delphi. And that's a good thing, because I think to a lot of us, this is not a settled case. Richard Allen, the man convicted of killing Liberty and Abby in that hiking trail, or on that hiking trail, right by that bridge, he is away for the rest of his life. But when you dive deep into it like we have over the years, and you can go back in our archives, Bob's or mine, and you will find there are far too many questions that do not have answers. So joining me to discuss, Bob Mata, defense attorney, host of the podcast Defense Diaries. You have been close to this as they were developing the documentary, and you've also just recently had some conversations with Andrew Baldwin as well, attorney for Richard Allen. Let's just start at the beginning here. Let's get everybody caught up. Where is the appeal process at this moment in time?
So the brief is in process of being drafted, and most recently, I think within the last 7 days, the appellate counsel filed for a request for an extension of time to get their brief filed. I think that they asked for, I'm guessing here based on my memory, I think it was a date of in and around September 7th. Mm-hmm. So, which means that at that point that they have to get their brief in. Once that happens, it obviously gets tendered over to the state, and whoever's preparing, I don't know if it's the attorney general for Indiana, whoever's going to handle the appeal for the state is going to file their reply brief or their response brief. So from a lot of people that I've talked to kind of in the know, in the Indiana kind of judiciary system, you know, lawyers and so forth, it sounds like the best guess is they might ask for one more extension of time. Mm-hmm. A lot of people are kind of guessing that this thing will get filed in October, but that doesn't mean that it won't get filed in September. But I'm guessing it'll be the next couple of months we'll get that brief, and we'll see what issues that they're pointing out.
So for people who aren't attorneys and don't know how this all works, what does it all mean exactly with these briefs being filed, and like what, where does this move down the line?
So the first thing that's filed after a conviction, typically in Indiana, and every state has different kind of different rules of what you have to do before you jump into your direct appeal, which is the first appeal That's what they call it, your direct appeal. But in Indiana, they had a vehicle called a motion to correct errors, which was filed in that case. And in that, they brought up a lot of things that they thought were incorrect about the trial that happened, things that were done and should have not been done, and things that were not done that should have been done. And, you know, I thought that it was a pretty compelling thing. That goes to Judge Gull, though. Mm-hmm. So Judge Gull, in our state, in Illinois, we file a motion for a new trial. Mm-hmm. And essentially, we do the same thing. You know, some lawyers will just kind of put a boilerplate pro forma type pleading together and just file it just to take that necessary step in order to get the appeal underway. So other lawyers will really like take a shot and, you know, identify issues that they think really do warrant a new trial without having to go through the process of the appeal. They're rarely ever granted, rarely. Mm-hmm. And obviously Gull did not grant the motion to correct errors. So once that was done, it was shifted directly into the hands of the appellate lawyers, and he's got a pretty capable, Stacey Liani, is a really good appellate lawyer in Indiana. Like, she's had a lot of success in criminal appeals. And, you know, what they're doing at this point, what you do in any direct appeal is the focus is on errors that were made during pretrial rulings, errors that were made during trial. And you're arguing that these aren't harmless error. Harmless error is the death knell to any appeal. That is basically where the appellate court looks at it and they say, okay, well, we agree that there was an error made. However, we find it to be harmless in the sense that had this error not been made, it wouldn't have changed the result of what the jury came back with in terms of their verdict.
Sure.
So, you know, but that's what you do with a direct appeal. You're looking for all the things. Like, I'm assuming that they will be attacking the fact that she didn't allow third-party culprit defense to come in any capacity. Mm-hmm. You know, that'll be a primary issue. The issue of the confessions, I think, will be brought up in what context depends on the way Stacey looks at it in terms of how do you argue whether or not these should have been admissible? Because I think there is a strong argument that that the confessions were coerced, not in your traditional type of interrogation type way where you hear about in cases where cops have somebody in there for 48 hours and they're just browbeating the hell out of them, not letting them sleep, you know, not giving them food or drink, whatever the case, sometimes getting violent with them, you know, telling them all the lies, and they coerce a confession out of them. This was different. This was more of a passive coercion that was really the conditions of the confinement and for the extended period of time in which that occurred with him,
yeah,
caused him to slip into psychosis and, you know, therefore making you know, that these weren't voluntary and or they were coerced or a combination of both.
Yeah.
So however she chooses to address that issue, and there's other issues that will be raised for certain. I think another really big issue in that case is how he ended up in a prison as opposed to jail. And that will be discussed in terms of the safekeeping hearing, the lack of due process in terms of Richard Allen not even being present at the time that they made this decision, mm-hmm, to put him in a prison for his own safekeeping, without him being present, without a lawyer on his behalf being present, and no notice to him that it was happening.
Yeah.
And the problem for the state is the fact that Allen has the ability to make a decision in that process, mm-hmm, in terms of if they are saying that we are doing this for your own safety, not for the safety of the other people around you, Richard Allen could say, you know what? I'm good. I'll just stay in the county jail. So he had the ability to make a decision on his own behalf with regards to whether or not he wanted to reject it, because they were saying that they were doing it for his own safety. Mm-hmm. You know, that they couldn't articulate any threats in particular. No one had made any threats in particular, but it was just their general feeling that because of the victims and their age, and traditionally how we know people that commit crimes against children are treated in prisons and jails, You know, that was their mindset that, look, if we put him in some place where somebody's going to have access to him, he won't even make it to trial. So that was their thinking. Problem is due process. You know, like he's got an absolute right to be there. No, that should never have happened without him being there.
Knowing what we know about this case and all of the shady, weird things in here, do you really think they were doing it to protect? I mean, I know, I get it. I get, like, in other cases where that would be done, and that makes sense. But seeing as all of this played out, was that really their intent?
I mean, you're asking a guy who happens to be of the mindset, and I say this, you know, with no hesitation. Yeah. I happen to think that he's wrongfully convicted.
Yeah.
In light of that, and I thought that the PCA leaned not guilty when I first read it, just because of the weakness of the evidence that they presented within it, which was essentially mere presence at the bridge, which came from him volunteering the information to him within 2 days of the crime occurring, and the unspent round.
Yeah.
Right. So, and that was it. And then you had a bunch of people that claimed that they saw somebody out on the bridge who the state has always opined was bridge guy. Mm-hmm. Yet not one of those people gave any kind of description that came even close to matching Richard Allen.
Yeah.
So when that thing came out, I'm like, this thing stinks. They have to have more. So when I'm thinking about it in terms of that, and then when I look back after sitting through the trial, and it turns out that that's what they had. They had those two things, and then their theory that this round that they found in the memory box was some kind of souvenir. That was essentially their evidence against him. Mm-hmm. Like they felt that if we can prove that Bridge Guy committed the crime and that Richard Allen, in our estimation, was there at the time that Bridge Guy was there, which is in dispute, it just is,
yeah.
You know, that we're going to be able to make this case. I think the reality is, if you ask any honest prosecutor the question, if these were the facts and evidence that you had at the point in time when you're deciding whether or not to move forward with this case, if you had your druthers, would you want more? Mm-hmm. Any prosecutor that's being honest would say, yes, I want more. When they get his devices after they do the search, and it was a lot of devices that they pulled from his house, you know, it was computers, you know, tablets, multiple phones, mm-hmm. 15, 16 phones, and they find nothing that you would expect to see from your typical kind of person that is going to commit this type of crime with this kind of violence mm-hmm. against girls, you know, young girls. You typically would see a buildup.
Yeah.
In terms of whether it was some kind of like torture porn, kiddie porn, whatever
you
it is.
You see what he's into. Yeah.
Right. Whatever yeah. he's like, he's building up to it. Like a 47, 48 year old man, it seems far fetched to me, just decides one day after he leaves his mother's house to go drive out to a bridge and kill two girls. Yeah. To me, in terms of what I've experienced in my career and dealing with some pretty bad people, that's not how this typically works.
That he doesn't even know are there. Like he has no idea who these girls. He just show up, just look for the kids, just look for whoever. You mean just right, randomly? Just, I mean,
total crime of opportunity. Yeah. You know, like just goes out there. So like the thing just stunk to me. So when you kind of look at it through that lens, and I can't help but look at it through that lens, and I realize that there's people out there that believe he's guilty and mm-hmm. that. You know, what? Like they found the round. Like that's straight evidence. You know, he said he was there. He's bridge guy. You know, I hear what they're saying. I reject it.
Yeah.
Just based on the fact that I really dug into this case very, very diligently. And that's my opinion. And my opinion is what it is. And I respect other people's opinions. But when you look at it in terms of the relative weakness, in my estimation, of the evidence, it became apparent to me that early on that they were going to need a confession from him.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the mindset going in. So that was a really long answer for a very short question on whether or not that was really what their intent was in terms of keeping him safe. No, I think that they thought if they got him in there and put him in the worst, you know, the worst of the worst in terms of prisons in Indiana and the most secure cell within the worst prison in Indiana. And they had the shit that happened to him, which is inmates screaming at him constantly, him being shut off from everything other than an hour a day You know, them shutting him off from ever being able to have face-to-face contact with the person that he needed it most from, which was Kathy, his wife of 35 years, that they were hoping that this guy would cave and say, hey, you know, we can get you out of here. We'll get you out to Cass County, but just say you did it. Just admit it. Just tell us you did it. And then eventually when he slips into psychosis, he starts saying, I did it. I think I did it. Yeah. They're telling me I did it.
You know, Murray's basically like, oh, we'll get a confession out of him. Just send him over here. We'll get it done for you. Something of that nature. Yeah.
Right. I mean, it didn't have to be like torturing him and beating him. It was
I mean, and that's what gets me about the confessions and all of that, because he's psychotic. He's between bites of poop confessing that he did this. You wouldn't be able to have him sign a legal document at that moment in time and deem it valid. Right. Why would a confession to murders be deemed valid right when he's also confessing to murdering his grandchildren that don't exist?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's going to definitely be one of the avenues of the appeal, you know, that he was that they weren't voluntary in that sense, and that he wasn't in any way, shape or form able to formulate clear thought at that point, you know, because like in the pushback you get is that when people are listening to these phone call overhears, you know, that he doesn't sound like a sweaty tooth madman. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like he sounds like he's got almost no affect when he's speaking, but you know, he's making full sentences. And I think that most people who don't understand mental illness and how it operates, I think when people think of psychosis, that they think that that's a constant state that somebody's in and they're always like a raving lunatic. Mm-hmm. And that's just not the case, you know? And I think that the concept of slipping in and out of reality and having an understanding of what's real and what's not real is something that is really difficult for people that have never had personal experience, whether it be themselves or whether it be somebody in their family, a loved one, a friend, whoever, whoever, you know, where you see it firsthand, just how vivid and real mental illness is. People have a hard time wrapping their mind around it, you know? And it's like, I get the pushback online. They're like, oh, well, he was meeting with Walla once, you know, like every day. I'm like, I don't give a shit. The guy was out of his mind.
Yeah.
Like that's not a relationship wherein he's feeling the kind of security that he needs to feel. Like nothing is going to be able to replace Kathy Allen being able to go visit her husband. Just sitting across behind a plexiglass, you know, window, like would have been everything to him. To have her be able to get there where he's making eye contact with her and, you know, she's saying, I love you. And, you know, even if he's slipping into it at that point, just having that come, like they knew that cutting him off. I mean, there's no other explanation as to why they cut him off from her.
Yeah.
Like this is a man who is presumed innocent at this point, who's being held in a prison, you know, and like people are like, oh, well, he was being treated better than the other prisoners. I'm like, well, no, he wasn't. And even if he was, he's a pretrial detainee. He still has all his rights under the law.
Yeah.
He's not a convicted felon. That's who's in prison. So you can't compare apples and oranges. He's in a different legal status than a convicted felon would be. So like all those arguments are just, to me, they hurt because it just shows the mindset of an awful lot of people out there that really just don't take into consideration people's mental health in this world.
Not at all. No. I mean, and that's such a huge part of this whole
huge
case. And the fact that he didn't, again, not convicted and being treated this way. That's the insane part about all of that. Let me ask you in that area. I know the argument of, well, we moved him here for his own safety and we ended up seeing what happened. Didn't have access to, doesn't he legally have the right to be able to have visitors to see his wife but not being convicted yet?
I mean, I would think so.
Isn't that all part of this? Like, it's just, there's so many things that are wrong. Is there any repercussion for the folks who made these decisions? I mean, obviously they think they got their guy on their books. They're done. He's over. He's gone. He's in prison. But if this were to get re-brought up and they were to finally go and say, look at all these crazy things you did to this man. and you just got away with it. Is there any repercussions for anybody in this system who allowed this atrocity to take place?
Yeah, I mean, there's you can file a 1983 civil rights action, mm-hmm. and it was a violation not only of his civil rights but his human rights.
Yeah,
you know, so yes, but the problem is there's a statute of limitations on that.
Yeah,
and from all accounts, that has not been filed. There hasn't even been notice of filing that has been filed. So I mean, the issue of whether the statute's going to run on that, but yeah, you sue them. You know, I mean,
why hasn't that been done?
I wish I could give you that answer, man. It's like, I'm behind the scenes in terms of knowing a lot of the people that have worked on the case. And I'm not getting any kind of real answer to that, Tony.
No,
it's befuddling to me. And a lot of people are really upset about it.
Like, with statute of limitations, you got to strike while you can do it. I mean, and get it in. Why not? I mean, there's everything else going on with this right now. I want to talk about Bridge Guy for a second. And this is a conversation I think we've had a long time ago. But since it's being brought back up again, how do we even know? This is what befuddled me the whole damn time. Why do we think Bridge Guy is the killer?
I don't know.
There's a guy that was caught on a videotape when the girls are trying to figure out where to go, and he just goes, "Yeah, down the hill," you know. And they edited the tape, so the audio plays at the wrong spot for years. And again, why do we think this is the killer? He number one, and he doesn't even look like Richard Allen from what we can tell. Doesn't have the same gait, doesn't have the same build. Other than that, they both own a Carhartt jacket, which is about 95% of people in Indiana.
In the Midwest.
In the Midwest, yes. I mean, it's just like, what is this? What ties Bridge Guy to the murders other than the fact he was one of many human beings on the trail that day? It just happened that it was their camera that picked it up when he was doing nothing suspicious other than walking. People go up for walks by themselves.
The easiest answer is convenience, and it makes a good story.
Ah.
I talk about it all the time. Yeah. Like the state comes up with a theory based on the evidence that they have. You've got some cops and then you've got a prosecutor that look at it and they come up with a theory.
Yeah.
And they're like, okay, well, early on when they recovered Libby's phone and they found this 46 second video, they're like, oh my God, like that's gotta be the guy that killed her.
Yeah.
Killed the girls, you know, so like that's their mindset immediately. And they operate from that point forward under the mindset that that's the guy.
I also,
you know? and it's like, sorry to interrupt you, but it's like that concept of hearing what you want to hear when you're listening to something. It's like them trying to claim that they hear a gun racking in that video, which I have watched 1 million times.
Yeah.
And they're walking over like those little quartz gravel rocks mm-hmm. that they always put on train tracks.
Yep.
Sticks.
Yeah.
All kinds of leaves, refuse. Yeah. For them to say that that's just you hearing what you need to hear in your mind saying, oh, yeah, you're hearing that. Because objectively, if you listen to it, there is no way in hell that you can hear any kind of gun racking, other things that they're claiming that they claim at trial that they think that they hear this guy say, you know, is like, it's all debatable because that concept of hearing what you want to hear is a real thing. Mm-hmm. You know, your brain will function that way. And it's just, you know, my biggest takeaway has always been, Tony, that Richard Allen is between 5'4", 5'5".
Mm-hmm.
When you see this dude in real life, he is the first thing that you're going to say. And I've been saying this for 2 years since the first time I laid eyes on him. It seems like now it's starting to pick up traction. I kept saying,
mm-hmm.
this guy, like the first time I saw him, I literally went, I'm like, holy shit, this guy is tiny.
Mm-hmm.
Like he stood 5-6 inches shorter than every other male in that entire courtroom. Mm-hmm. The first thing that you were going to say when describing him is he's really short.
Mm-hmm.
So when you have these people who were the witnesses who testified at trial and who they included in their probable cause affidavit, all giving varying descriptions, none of which come even remotely close physically
mm-hmm.
to describing Richard Allen. But my biggest takeaway is that not one of them, not one person said he was really short.
Yeah.
And like he's that short to where if you were asked to describe him, that would be the first thing that you'd say about him. He's really short.
Yeah.
Really short guy. I don't like how tall. I don't know. Really short. Like 5'3", 5'4". You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
No one says that. And it's such a distinctive aspect of his physical makeup that I find it impossible that any of these people saw Richard Allen.
Yeah. Now, I agree. It's just another piece. When they presented these things in court, where they're talking about, what is that? Well, that's a gun racking. According to who? You? And where do you have the proof? There were so many things that were just said so factually in court that was like, according to what? Like, what?
Is this your opinion?
It's just, and I also reject this one too. And I, this is in no way, in any way, anything negative towards those girls, but it's the narrative that these girls saw their lives were about to end and they were about to be attacked by this guy, which clearly is not what's happening in the video, that they thought well enough to go and start videotaping him. That's not why they're videotaping. They're videotaping because they're preteen girls and they like to videotape.
And they're snapping. They're posting to social media.
They're not sitting there going, that guy's going to kill us. Let's slightly get his picture. Like, no, they're not. That's the last thing on their minds at that moment in time. It wasn't like let's get this so that somebody finds our bodies and we have the killer on camera.
But again, man, that is what the job of a prosecutor is. I mean, any trial that you watch, like they're not speaking in what ifs, right? Like when you're watching a trial and the prosecutor saying, this person did this, mm-hmm. they're pointing at him in court. This person is a murderer. This person committed these heinous crimes. There is no maybes. They come at the jurors with definitives. Mm-hmm. Like everything that we're telling you is gospel.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's why things like jury instructions are so important, because mm-hmm. those instructions are read to the jurors. They're sent back with them and they need to understand that that's how lawyers talk.
Mm-hmm.
Lawyers speak in definitives. They weren't there. Mm-hmm. They have no idea. They're just coming at you with their theory of events as to what happened. And the way that they portray their theory as if it's facts,
mm-hmm.
you know, like there is no doubt. My factual scenario, my theory that I have developed here is exactly what happened. Mm-hmm. Trust me, bro.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, that's just how lawyers sell the case. That's why you have cross-examination. That's why you have, you know, trials to challenge that theory, to say, okay, we know what their theory is. And that's the other reason when you think about how criminal trials operate, the prosecutors, they don't get to hold back on what their theory of the case is. They have to put it out there. And the reason is so that defense attorneys can look at it,
mm-hmm.
evaluate it, look at the evidence and say, okay, this theory sucks. Or this theory is really powerful, and I think they got it right. You know what I mean? And it's like, this case just is not that, because there's just not enough evidence. And the evidence that they do have, starting with that unspent round, man, is just not the type of evidence that you can put a person in prison for 130 years based on.
I want to talk about that unspent round because, and I don't know if you know the answer to that, but is there any images of this unspent round prior to them getting Richard Allen's gun in their custody?
There is one photograph of it in the ground.
Uh-huh.
And then the next photograph of it is in some lab on a counter. So there is no photograph of them picking it up. There's no real chain of custody in terms of photographing. Yeah.
They're not good enough photographs where you can look at it and go, oh, these are the markings. We only saw those photos of the bullet markings after they confiscated Richard Allen's gun.
Correct.
So to me, this was just seeing everything else as it played out in here, I don't know. I mean, I'd have very little faith in that whole investigation. My thought was, well, yeah, they took their bullet in evidence. They confiscated his gun. They racked it through. Look, it has the markings of his gun.
Right. I mean,
that seems pretty simple to do. I mean, it would take three seconds.
In terms of the round itself, the lab looked at the round.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, because we know that it came back inconclusive as to Brad Weber's
mm-hmm.
weapon. He had the same make and model, same caliber weapon.
Mm-hmm.
And they came back inconclusive. Now, if you don't have any familiarity with who Brad Weber is,
mm-hmm.
Brad Weber had a private drive that was to the north side of Deer Creek, which is a little creek that runs under the Monon High Bridge.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And his property, where that private drive leads directly to his property.
Mm-hmm.
Additionally, Ron Logan, I'm not 100% on this, so I don't even want to say it, but I don't know if he had the same caliber weapon, but I know for a fact that Brad Weber's weapon came back as inconclusive. So, mm-hmm. and I know that there was another weapon, and I can't remember if it was Logan's or not, and I don't want to misquote the facts.
Sure.
But there was another weapon that they came back that they had tested that it was inconclusive. So they did have this round,
mm-hmm.
okay? And the lab had looked at it under a microscope. And so, and they had tried to make some matches. So before they got Richard Allen's weapon, there existed some photographs of the lab work that had been done.
Mm-hmm.
Whether or not that are those the same photograph? I don't know.
Yeah.
That's a much different conversation.
That's where chain of custody comes in. And then you're also relying on who's giving you that information as to, well, was this doctored, you know?
And the motive of the state to get a conviction on a case that's 5 years cold.
Yeah.
You know, and the other thing is that, like, I don't care what anybody says. And if you ask anybody who's legitimate in terms of that very specious kind of scientific evidence, it's highly challenged these days. Mm-hmm. A lot of courts are starting to turn around and say, you know, it's not the type of evidence that we're going to allow in.
Mm-hmm.
We can't have people getting convicted on this type of evidence. It's just not sound enough.
Yeah.
But the bottom line is that she could not reproduce marks that came anywhere near to what she needed to be able to even make a comparison by just racking his weapon.
Yeah.
So what that tells you is that she wasn't able to duplicate those marks with what they're saying happened to that round, which was the gun was racked and it ejected out.
Yeah.
So in order to make an apples to apples comparison, it would have had to have happened when she did that testing. She couldn't get it done. She mm-hmm. couldn't get it to make any marks that were visible to her.
Yeah.
So it just wasn't leaving enough in terms of ballistic evidence or tool markings on the round for her to make the comparison. So then ultimately she ends up having to fire rounds.
Mm-hmm.
When it fires the round, it makes markings that are visible enough under the microscope for her to see, and then she makes the comparison. And you're talking about apples and oranges at that point.
And no gun was used in the crime.
Right. And it wasn't right. It was a gun was never used.
Yeah.
It was shot. Yeah. It's crazy, yeah. man. It's crazy.
They've moved him to Oklahoma now. And I know this happens in the prison system. People get moved around. It seems, again, it's just a little weird considering, you know, he's trying to work with his attorneys in Indiana. You know, his wife is in Indiana for any sort of visitation. He's now he's in Oklahoma. Do you read anything into this of is this part of this whole thing? Is this another chapter of let's make it more difficult for him on his appeal? Or was this just literally a prison transfer?
To be honest with you, I mean, there's got to be some kind of an agreement between Indiana and Oklahoma for them to just try. Like, I mean, typically, typically you serve your sentence in the state in which you're sentenced in. It's not to say, I mean, I've certainly heard of prisoners of note being moved out of state to different prisons. It's typically for security reasons.
Yeah.
But in terms of why Richard Allen was moved, I have not been able to get any information, and people that are in the know have not been able to get any information as to why that happened. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, look, with appeals, the defendant doesn't go in there and sit in the appellate court while those get argued anyway.
Sure, sure.
It's not going to affect his ability to you know, have his appeal heard mm-hmm. and litigated at all. It does move him hours and hours and hundreds of miles away from his wife.
Yeah.
In terms of her being able to visit. But from what I understand, Kathy had not been able, she hasn't been able to visit Richard since he was convicted.
Really?
From what I've heard.
Yeah.
From what I've heard. So I you know, I don't know, man.
Do they not allow visitation? I mean,
of course they do. Yeah.
Then why would she, I mean, what's the,
I don't know.
Yeah.
Man. But
yeah.
It's the same answer when he's a pretrial detainee, yeah. why they're not allowing her to visit.
Sure. Him. Sure.
Like what is there, does there exist a reasonable explanation?
Do we know,
do
we know what is he in solitary confinement now? Do we know what's where he's at or how he's being held within the confines of the prison?
I would assume that it's some kind of protective custody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like he could be being held in a very similar circumstance to which he was being held in,
yeah.
you know, in Indiana pretrial,
yeah.
you know, where he's in a cell 23 hours a day, losing his shit.
And you that's what like, I wonder about. Cause that's my big question. How is he today? Do we know how he is today?
You know what we can figure based on what we saw from the first time they had him in prison for 13 months in yeah. solitary, he's not doing better.
Yeah.
You know, like that's for certain. Like he's not doing better. I mean, prisons just are not the type of place where they're overly concerned about your mental well-being.
No, no.
Like that's just not, it's not what they do. I mean, it's not to say that they don't have people that they have available to talk, you know, with inmates when they're suffering mentally.
Yeah.
Because I'm sure they do. But in terms of, is that their primary concern?
Not at all.
Not. No. It's just not.
And the thing is, like, once this, I mean, if and when, or if we end up getting to another trial, these appeals work, if something happens, what's going to be left of this man by the right. time, if he ever is let out, if ever found not guilty, if they find that this was all a big sham and he goes free, I don't know what you're going to have there. And
I mean, yeah. a shell of a man.
Yeah.
Literally.
Yeah. I feel horrible. Kathy's, it was very good. I'm very happy she was in that documentary. She's needed to have her voice heard in this to, I think, show the world more of who he is. And yeah. this is like a normal family. And she's yeah. came across just like a normal woman because she is. And it was just, it humanized this more, I thought. And it showed just the torture that she's had to go through in this as well, having her husband ripped away.
Her whole life
was
shattered
yeah.
in the blink of an eye.
It's just
everything that was normal for them
yeah.
was ended the day that they decided to search their house. Like yeah. and like the people that try to impute some consciousness of guilt type argument to him saying mm-hmm. it doesn't fucking matter, it's over. In terms of like, oh, there he is. He's saying that it was over because they searched it. He was saying what you've done in terms of searching my home, mm-hmm. the way that you searched it in my neighborhood, in this small town for this crime,
yeah.
you've fucking ended my life.
Yeah.
Like you've destroyed my reputation. There is no coming back from it.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, this is that case, T, where if he is given a new trial through direct appeal or if it's through post-conviction mm-hmm. Petition and he gets a new trial and he's found not guilty, there are going to be people that are always going yeah. to fucking think that that man is the guy.
Sure.
You know, I mean, his life in terms of normality is
Yeah, there's no returning back to normal life ever.
And I don't care where he moves. Yeah. You know, I mean, clearly they'd have to move out of Indiana. But to your point, you know, I spent a lot of time. I sat next to Kathy Allen every day during that trial. And, you know, I told her my role for her was to explain what was going on because she's just a sweet, you know, Midwestern gal who has no experience with the criminal justice system, has no experience with any of this, and whose life has been shattered. And, you know, I wanted to be able to be available to her because if you don't think that Kathy Allen's a victim, that you don't understand what being a victim is.
Because
it takes all different forms. And that woman is that entire family, like Jan, his mother. And I mean, they're just salt of the earth, as sweet as you can imagine. I mean, I broke bread with these people on many, many occasions. They're just a genuinely nice family. Like these, there's nothing strange about any of them. Kathy is just like every woman that I've ever met from the Midwest, who's just like loves her husband, long time marriage, you know, just a straight shooter and just a really, really down to earth, nice person. And, you know, I'm heartbroken for her and she is feeling every bit of all of this still. You know, I mean, I'm in communication with her and she's just a puddle, like, and understandably so. Like, she is just not, you don't recover from this.
No.
I mean, it's like there is, you know, and it's like she wants to be strong. She's going to be there for her husband. But in terms of the day to day, when he's now gone in a prison and that's her new reality, it's a hard reality to live in, man.
I hope she keeps speaking out. I hope the family keeps speaking out because I think Richard needs that. And this can't be easy. And I'm sure they get grief from, you know, people who disagree with them too. But I felt that was so powerful. So I really hope that she keeps talking and letting his story and their story be told. Cause I think that is going to help move the needle more than anything is her helping to put that human 100%. Side to him.
Yeah.
Without a doubt.
I could not agree more. And the other thing before we jump off of that subject, the other thing that it made me just rehash was that I was so firmly of the mindset that she should have been called to trial. Mm-hmm. They needed to hear from her.
Yeah.
And like watching her and just seeing her humanity and putting humanity into context for that jury in terms of this is who these people were. Mm-hmm. It's huge, man. Yeah, and completely. It didn't happen. And it's like, I'm like, oh my God. Cause like during the trial, like leading up to the last day of trial, I'm asking Kathy, I'm like, does it seem like they're going to call you? Mm-hmm. She's like, I don't know. I'm like, they need to call you.
Yeah.
You know, and it's that's a strategic decision, you know, and sure. I'm sure the defense had reasons why they were worried about it. I mean, I to me, that was a mistake.
Yeah. And it opens her up to cross. It opens up to all that shit. And I mean,
you know what though? It's like, if they're worried about the part of the interrogation where Kathy has been brought in from the hallway, where if you guys have never seen the interrogation videos, I highly recommend watch them.
Go look. Yeah.
They're out there. Yeah, they're everywhere. We've got them on my channel. Yeah. I'm sure T's got them on his channel. But go watch them. They're worth your time. And just try to look at them objectively and try to watch them in terms of, am I watching a guilty person that has been able to evade law enforcement for 5 years, whose jig is finally up? Is that who you're looking at when you're watching these two separate interviews? And you come to your own conclusions on that. But when Kathy, I need people to understand that when she is out in the hallway while Jerry Holman is going at Richard Allen really, really hard in this room, she is being told by other law enforcement officers what they have against her husband. Okay. So she is being fed information by the people that are trying to persecute her husband. This is what, so she walks into that room thinking, I don't know what to think. And they've just told me they have all this evidence against you. And she says that thing like, where she says, I don't remember you telling me you went out to the bridge.
Yeah.
And he's like, I was out there. He's like, I told you I was out there.
Yeah.
And she's like, I just don't remember that. And like that conversation wasn't allowed to develop as much as like him saying, I told you I was out at the trails. And like, that means if I'm out at the trails, I'm going out to the bridge. Like,
yeah,
I didn't need to articulate exactly that I was out on the bridge. Yeah. Cause if he didn't see the girls, he wouldn't think to be like, oh yeah, they walked right by
it's
me.
Like, I was by the elm tree. Of course you were. Yeah.
You know, but like that part of it is, you know, it's frustrating, man. It's frustrating. Yeah. And those are all the things in terms of what she could have testified to. But like, that's what I'm saying. Like, if that's what they were concerned with, that would have been easy enough to flesh out. And frankly, I think you could have really have helped that situation, because there is the people that believe that he's guilty, that they believe that that's a damning statement. Like, oh, look, he didn't even tell her he went out to the bridge proper. Like, he kept that part out.
Yeah. And when you selectively look at that, then you look back at your own conversations with your spouse or whoever, and like, how many times have you had that conversation with someone where it's like, wait, well, it's implied. It's like, it's all right. It's like, this is just normal husband-wife communication. Like, it's nothing. And she's, like you said, she's just presented with all this crazy shit that was thrown at her as fact. And now go back to your husband. And then she's going to be on notice. She's going to be.
Could you imagine where your head would be like at that moment in time?
Yeah,
like,
it's all a mind fuck. I mean, it's
a
completely
total mind fuck, man.
And they knew how to play it. I mean, and the Jerry Holmes, like, yeah, all of that with him and his interrogation. I mean, this is, when you watch it, yes, watch it objectively. Watch and go, is this an innocent man? Also look at Jerry Holman and the others who are interrogating him and go, is this a man who failed it, who could not get a job as a used car salesman? So he went into law enforcement. Because that's how it feels. It's like, this is an angry man who didn't get the sale of the Pinto on the lot. And he's angry. And he doesn't really have very effective tactics or very well thought out tactics on how he's going to do this. But he watched some crime shows in 85. And that's what he's still going with. And that's how it feels. It's like, oh, well, if
he's no Columbo. No,
if this doesn't work out, you know, the Honda dealership always needs some high pressure salespeople that are there for you. And I'll bet you anything, on Saturdays when they bring out the balloons and the big flags and they have the lunch, the hot dogs out there grilling, I can guarantee that man's probably at the front of the line in front of all the customers.
And the big inflatable guy.
Big inflatable, the big wavy inflatables. Yep. Yeah, he's sitting there. Okay, lunch is served and all the customers, he's, oh, I'll take some of that potato salad.
George Costanza trying to get out of the burning building style.
That's him. Again, just conjecture, and I'm just joking, kind of. But
me too.
Yeah. Bob Mata, defense attorney, the podcast Defense Diaries. You can get it wherever you get podcasts and also on YouTube. Go check it out. As always, thank you for your insight into this case.
Always, man. Yeah. It's always one of my favorite times of the week when we get to chat.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Mornings can start feeling the same. Wake up, brush teeth, go to work. But with breakfast from Wendy's, it's like, wake up, brush teeth, baconate with a breakfast baconator, roll with the sausage breakfast burrito, buddy it up with a honey buddy, or get seasoned with seasoned potatoes, and then go to work. Sorry. When you're ready for a fresh wake-up call, gotta be Wendy's.
At participating U.S. Wendy's during breakfast hours.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care. Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care. Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care. Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care. Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care. Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Thanks for selling your car to Carvana. Here's your check.
Whoa, when did I get here?
What do you mean?
I swear it was just moments ago that I accepted a great offer from Carvana online. I must have time traveled to the future.
It was just moments ago. We do same-day pickup. Here's your check for that great offer.
It is the future.
It's the present and just the convenience of Carvana. Sorry to blow your mind.
It's all good. Happens all the time.
Sell your car the convenient way to
Carvana.
Pickup times may vary and fees may apply.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.